Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now back to the crisis in Ukraine and a different point of view than the dominant ones in the American media. Stephen Cohen is a Russia expert and professor emeritus at NYU and Princeton and a contributing editor to The Nation. He wrote a controversial piece in The Nation defending Vladimir Putin from what Cohen says is media malpractice in the United States. Cohen, in turn, has gotten roundly denounced in The New Republic, The Daily Beast, and elsewhere. Let's hear his case. Stephen Cohen, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Do you think Putin is right to have sent Russian troops into Crimea and the West is wrong to be denouncing that?
I don't think Putin had any choice, but if I could just revise where I'm standing.
Sure.
I'm not defending Putin in that article in The Nation. I'm protesting the distortion of Russia under Putin and Putin's leadership during the last 14 years. And the argument was, in the first sentence of the piece, that these distortions, the demonization of Putin, is jeopardizing American national security. And the truth of that, alas, because I wrote that article 3 years ago, we are now in a position where we have the worst international crisis of our time, and serious people are calling Putin Hitler. That's the kind of thing I was warning against. So here we are.
Well, forget Hitler. You question the media, calling Putin an autocrat. You write that he lacks such power. You really think so?
Yes, I know so. An autocrat, let me be a little scholarly, an autocrat in political science means a leader who holds all power in the system, a despot. Putin doesn't hold all power. He is by far the number one dominant leader, but he's accountable to his own political elite, and that political elite is divided. Part of the Russian political elite, and this has been the case since the end of the Soviet Union 22 years ago, has wanted Russia to move solidly toward the West. The other part says you can't trust the West, they will never accept us, and let's move toward what we call Eurasia, which is because Russia sits in Europe and Asia, and that includes a strategic partnership with China. This debate has been going on for 22 years. It shifted toward the anti-Western forces in Russia, and Putin is answerable, though, to both. He does not have complete power. It's simply the reality. Ask anybody who actually studies from a scholarly point of view, the way the system works today.
But as the New Republic article mentions, he has stymied a free press and cracked down mercilessly on all opposition and on civil society. They question you, citing his popularity, wondering if that could even be legitimate in such a condition. And if he is stymieing a free press, if he's cracking down mercilessly on all opposition, putting his main, opponents in prison in some cases, and clamping down on civil society, how different is that from something we would call an autocracy?
Well, autocracy, again, refers to the power of the leader. But let's leave that aside. I've stated what I think is the reality and go to these other two issues. In the context of Russian history, let's take the last 400 years. With the exception of Gorbachev, who was the leader of the Soviet Union from 1985 to 1991, and arguably, though this is something that's more nuanced, Boris Yeltsin, who was the first president of post-Soviet Russia from 1992 to 1999, leaving those two leaders aside, Vladimir Putin is the softest authoritarian leader in Russian history. I hope you understand what I'm saying. We're not talking about America, England, or France. We're talking about Russia. You analyze a leader in the context of his or her own history, not in the context of ours. You ask two questions. Where is Russia at politically, at home? Leave aside foreign policy for the moment. Under Putin. And it is more, I'm not going to use the word democratic because Russia is stuck somewhere between the Soviet system and democracy, stuck in the middle. It's in some kind of transition. But in the context of Russian history, Putin is a soft, soft authoritarian leader. This business about shutting down the press and attacking civil society. I don't even know what civil society means. I don't. For example, normally we consider independent political parties as part of civil society. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
All right. The largest opposition party in Russia today, like it or not, the only opposition party with a nationwide electoral capacity is the Russian Communist Party. There's no crackdown on the Russian Communist Party. There's no crackdown on the independent trade unions in the provinces, which are trying to get miners and others a fair deal. As for civil society, maybe 200,000 people went into the streets to protest against Putin in 2011, 2012. You remember those because those were widely covered in the Western press.
Yes.
Yes, there was a crackdown on some of those people. How many are in prison today? Very few.
But the isn't the crackdown on those who are symbolically selected to chill those protest movements and meaningful political opposition, like what's his name? Is it Khodorkovsky, who was released from prison in December?
Yes.
But
yes.
The fact that he was such a main political rival to Putin and was imprisoned in the first place, or a Pussy Riot with their cultural prominence and what they represent, being actually put in prison, and then you praise Putin for releasing them in December, but what message did he send in the first place?
I did not praise Putin for releasing Pussy Riot or Khodorkovsky. What I said was that Putin gets credit for nothing. In December, he enacted an amnesty. Amnesties are traditions in Russia. They don't happen every year, but usually they happen at the end of the year, on New Year's, for example, or some big holiday. He released about 1,000 people in prison, a large number of them women with children. Do we applaud that? I do personally, but it was never mentioned. Everybody focused on Khodorkovsky. You don't want to take me back to the Khodorkovsky case in 2003. I mean, I knew, not well, but I knew, I met with him four or five times, Khodorkovsky. I liked him, but that was an Enron case. And we can debate the extent to which it was political, but the notion that Khodorkovsky, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was a threat to Putin politically back in 2003 is utter total nonsense. As Khodorkovsky's own mother has said, Khodorkovsky is Jewish. The notion that the Russians would elect a Jewish person as president of Russia is plausible only to somebody who doesn't know Russia. That had to do with something else. Should Khodorkovsky have been in prison for 10 years? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But it was a case that was complicated, that involved oil, that involved a system whose legality is still in flux. As for Pussy Riot, I simply don't consider this serious. Pussy Riot is not an opposition movement, only in the most remote sense of cultural politics. Somebody asked in the Times, for example, what country would arrest such nice girls for doing what they did in a church? And somebody in Europe who knows religious law around the world said about 80 countries, half of which, they would have been vulnerable to the death sentence. I don't think Pussy Riot should have been in prison. If they had done that in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, what they did, in all likelihood they would have been arrested, released on bond immediately, given a suspended sentence of 6 months, and told to go clean graffiti off subways.
Right.
Russia doesn't have that kind of judicial system.
My guest is Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus, Russia expert from NYU and Princeton, contributing editor to The Nation. We can take phone calls for him on his take, as you've been hearing it or reading it, and on, the Ukraine situation in general, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. Let's get back to Ukraine. Tell us more about why you say Putin had to send troops to Crimea.
All right, let's remember exactly where we are at the moment. What you and I, I'm probably older than you, but what you and I lived through, the last Cold War, the dividing line between West and East was in Berlin, correct? I mean, the wall,
right.
The so-called Iron Curtain.
Sure.
Excuse me. That was rather far away from Russia. We survived 45-year Cold War. Historians tell us we were lucky. The Cold War divide has now been moved to Russia's border. Ukraine. That is exceedingly dangerous. It's fraught with all sorts of lethal possibilities. Now let's flash to Russia. Let's give the Kremlin a break. Let's try to see what's happened through their eyes. Since the 1990s, when President Clinton began that, we, the United States and Europe, have moved NATO, our military alliance, from Berlin to Russia's borders, to the Baltics, right on Russia's borders. Like Pac-Man, the Western power has come west eastward across Europe, gobbling up everything. We've had conflicts over NATO expansion before, but all along, Putin has made clear that he has a red line. You remember, Obama had a red line in Libya, but he didn't act on it. But Putin was serious. The red line is Ukraine for historical, political, military, cultural, ethnic reasons. And the inner red line, the bullseye in the center of the red line, is Crimea, where the Russian naval base is. Rightly or wrongly, and this should be debated, the events that began in Ukraine in November with peaceful protests and then turned violent was seen from by the Kremlin as part of a political kind of vanguard of the movement of the West to take Ukraine. Is that crazy? Is it delusional? Is it paranoid? No. But it needs to be discussed.
But was it a vanguard of the West to take Ukraine, or was it an indigenous Ukrainian movement that had so many thousands of people out in the streets in Kiev protesting Yanukovych and the anti-democratic measures that had been passed in January?
You're absolutely right. That's the key question. And the answer is there is no the Ukraine. There is no the Ukrainian people. At a minimum, there are two. Those who live in the east and the south have a powerful affinity with Russia, including tens of millions of intermarriages. Keep that in mind. Those who live in Kiev, not all of them, but let's just take that for the sake of argument, Kiev and West Ukraine, because they came out of Western empires, the Austrian and the Polish Empire, whereas those in the East and the South came out of the Russian Empire, those in the West look to Europe. There are two Ukraines. Everybody has known this for the last 22 years. What was the purpose of doing something that provoked a split between the two Ukraines? And when the protest turned violent in the streets of Kiev, what you saw was the potential of civil war in Ukraine. It was reckless to provoke that confrontation. Now we're in a situation where we got to figure a way out of it. But the reality is, if we're going to have a serious discussion about Ukraine, is we're dealing with two Ukraines. It's an artificial state. Let me put it to you like this. There was one Ukrainian state, but there was no one Ukraine. There were at least two, and that's the reality today. And you see it in the news, as we see one thing's happening in South and East Ukraine, another's happening in West Ukraine.
So
maybe the country should be two countries. I don't know. But let's have a discussion. But you can't have a discussion when you're running around saying Putin is Saddam, he's Assad, he's Hitler. It just stops the discussion.
And maybe there should be two Ukraines. And I think that Crimea, with its ethnic Russian population, was already moving towards some kind of process of independence or affiliation with Russia. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
And the Ukrainians in Western Ukraine, who are more Western, they didn't like what Yanukovych was doing, which seemed to be moving toward Russia against the will of the people.
No, don't go to the people.
There's Western Ukraine.
Okay, we agree, Brian. Now let me ask you a question. Yanukovych in November did something that triggered the protests. He decided not to sign the National Accord, economic allegedly, but it had military provisions with Western Ukraine. You and I agree on that. That's what triggered the protests, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right. He was democratically elected. He's a very bad man. He's a bad, bad, bad man, corrupt, cowardly, and more. But he was elected democratically. The next presidential election was scheduled for March 2015, just over a year away. Now, let me ask you a question. If the Tea Party were to seize the White House and Obama were to flee and the Tea Party put Ted Cruz in the presidency, Would we consider that democratic? Absolutely not. What we should have said to the Ukrainian protesters and to the Ukrainian government is, okay, you don't want Yanukovych. Fine. In 13 months, you have a presidential election. Organize. Do what Democrats do. And by the way, 2 weeks ago, no, on February 21, the European Union ministers brokered a deal with Yanukovych. You'll remember this, which everybody said, oh, this ends the crisis, that there would be new elections move forward to December, 10 months away, for the presidency. In return, Yanukovych amnestied all the people who had been arrested during the protest, and other compromises were made. Everybody in the West said, that's great, let's do it. 8 hours later, the protesters, not the protesters, but the tough guys, the armed ones, the ones who, some of whom are very anti-Semitic, anti-European, seized the presidential residence, occupied the parliament, and transformed, burned up that degree, that accord that had been negotiated by the European Union. And what you got now is this rump parliament, which has no legitimacy in international or constitutional law. About this, Putin is 100% right. By the way, both Putin and Obama are lawyers. They can read the documents. And that is where we stand now. Now, our strategy now is to say that the government in Kiev is legitimate. Putin's position is not legitimate. And that's where things stand legally.
And I agree with
you. That is the reality of events. That's what happened.
And I agree with you that that is a central question, is was a democratically elected president removed by a popular coup with support from the West, which is a principle that neither of us would support. Maybe the same thing happened in Egypt with Morsi rather than waiting for the next election. Or maybe something similar happened in the two countries, which is that the Ukrainian legislature adopted, and here I'm going to use the Daily Beast language, but Ukrainian legislature adopted and Yanukovych signed a set of 10 laws in January that collectively smothered freedom of speech, the press, and association, regulations that led Yale Ukraine expert Timothy Snyder to conclude that on paper, Ukraine is now a dictatorship. So does that matter to how we see Yanukovych and whether they could have waited till the next election because there may not have been a meaningful next election?
I have no idea what the Daily Beast is talking about. Look, I am a patriot of American national security. I resent being called a Putin apologist. I grew up in Kentucky. I have bourbon, bluegrass, and basketball still surging through my veins. But we are at the greatest risk we've been at since 9/11. And it's the kind of risk that's going to shape the lives of our kids, and I got grandkids. I care about this. I don't claim I'm 100% right, but I do claim that we will never abet our national security if we're calling each other names, one, and if we don't recognize the facts, the actual events that happened since November. You made the point. You and I don't approve of overthrowing popularly elected presidents, even if he or she turns out to be a complete rotter. Once that happened, and by the way, the deal, let me repeat to you, was brokered by the European foreign ministers, signed off on by Obama and Kerry, and it was dead in the street 6 hours later. What the White House in Brussels should have done at that moment, that was on February 21, 22, 23, is said, no, stop. We do not support this. Yanukovych is the president. Feel free to get rid of him in what was now only 10 months and restore every deputy to the parliament safely to his seats. But I guarantee you, Brian, if you and I were members of Yanukovych's party, also democratically elected, and guys with black ski masks on their face came in, big, burly guys, into the parliament, you and I would have fled, too. We would have fled. And the parliament in Kiev now is a rump parliament. It is not a full parliament. It's frightened.
We're over time, but this is so interesting and important. Let me get in a couple of callers for you.
Please.
From our very packed board. John in East Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Dr. Cohen, I read your book about Nikolai Bukharin, so I just wanted to say that.
Oh, my God, John, you must be quite elderly.
No, I'm not. You mentioned that Putin hasn't cracked down on the Now, I lived in Moscow for 15 years, and about his crackdown on the, or not crackdown on the Communist Party, but I read a theory of many years back that he effectively split the Communist Party by creating a party known as the Agrarian Party that took votes away from the Communist Party, you know, a party that had a very similar agenda of the Communist Party, but effectively took votes away and divided it, the Communist Party, into two blocks, and that this was a very scheming way of sort of reducing the power of the Communist Party. I've never heard this really investigated further, but I've always...
Well, John, thank you. And Steve, very, very briefly on this, okay?
Very briefly, if the Communist Party in Russia today, which, by the way, has behaved democratically and in elections in the parliament since 1993, were to be given free, equal chance at elections, I think they get about 33% of the vote in Russia today. They get now, as it is now, just under 20. Let me go to another point, though, Brian, because you raised it. Putin has cracked down on television. The national networks, of which there are three or four, are pretty much controlled by the Kremlin. We agree on that. 80% of Russians get their political news from television, as do about 80% of Americans. However, the print media, there are dozens of anti-Putin newspapers. And by the way, both Democratic and anti-Democratic. Anti-Democratic newspapers are also against Putin. They think he's soft. I am very close to the most Democratic newspaper in Russia. It's called Novaya Gazeta. That's the newspaper whose correspondents keep getting assassinated. I celebrated my birthday in Moscow in December at that newspaper. They threw a party for me. It was also my wedding anniversary. I am very close to that paper. I side with the Democratic opposition in Russia. But what's going on is destroying the Democratic opposition in Russia. It is destroying it. Putin had 65% favorable when the Ukrainian crisis began. When the next poll was taken, and by the way, these are not only Russian survey polling organizations, includes Gallup. I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow he's got 91%. I'm speaking rhetorically a little bit here, but the point is we're driving his popularity in Russia upward.
One more. Robert in Manhattanville. You're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian. Great show. Professor Cohen, I was a student of yours at Princeton, so I know how good you are in Russian history. But I commend to you, Brian, and your guest and the audience, Timothy Snyder's excellent piece in the New York Review of Books about the composition of the people in the Maidan. And I don't think the professors got the correct view of it. But notwithstanding that, could the professor address this point, that all of this is a tactical blunder on the part of Putin, not now, but when the crisis was unfolding? Putin has talked about how he doesn't like Yanukovych, that he could have defused the problem, picked up the phone to Obama, said, "You owe me, and this is my backyard, let's defuse the problem," and resolve it before it turned out to be a bloody problem and a problem for Putin, in that now he's, not that it is accurate, but the West has now viewed Putin with fear, like an era of the 20th century.
And Robert, I'm going to leave it there. And Steve Cohen, we have a minute for your final response.
Well, you see, I create the right kind of, I don't create, but I help shape the right kind of students. They study with me and they disagree with me. And that's what you should do.
We're
you
all
should,
for that.
You should teach. All right. Look, in November, December, Brian, and all your listeners, when this crisis began to unfold, Putin said, "Stop. Why are you, the West, giving Ukraine an either-or choice?" At that moment, it was an economic issue, how to save the Ukrainian economy. We, Russia, will join with the European Union for a kind of a mini Marshall Plan to save Ukraine. And all the other issues of which way Ukraine will tilt will be put off until the Ukrainian economic crisis is solved. The West said no. Ukraine must decide now. That's when Yanukovych did not sign the Western Accord, whether it's with Europe or with Russia. Why would you do that to a country that is profoundly divided politically, ethnically, in every conceivable way? Why would you impose an either-or choice on a country that had a latent civil war going on? Why would you do that?
And we leave the rhetorical question as the last words. in this conversation with Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus at NYU in Princeton, contributing editor to The Nation, where you can read his article, Distorting Russia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.